Right. After this act of contrition, we should make an act of deep respect to the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, for they deserve our offerings and respect in whatever life we may be drifting. The Buddhas and patriarchs transmitted respect for the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha from India to China. Respect is not quite the right word. It is much closer to an act of love than an act of respect. Much closer to an act of love. Having any of you who have ever experienced the joy that comes as a result of a first confession, if you're a Catholic or something similar, will know the incredible feeling of relief and love that seems to come as a result of having made that confession. Anybody here ever experienced that? It's a quite remarkable and very beautiful thing. And that is really what is meant by respect here. It's very difficult to translate some of the words adequately. Unfortunately, the word love has become somewhat wishy-washy in these days. And so respect comes out at fairly close, but is not really the right term. Now, I'm sure many of you have heard of the statement that in the beginning trees are trees and mountains are mountains. Later on, neither trees nor mountains are what they seem to be. And later again, trees again become trees and mountains become mountains. It's an old Zen saying. Anybody heard that? Yes. Right. In the beginning, we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. That is where we start. We take refuge. Then we seem to go away from that in the way in which we study doctrines and theories and ideas and notions, and we find ourselves coming back to taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But the second taking refuge is not the same as the first taking refuge. In the beginning, we did it because we believed that this was the right thing to do, because people told us this was the right thing to do. In the end, we do it because everything in our blood and bones knows that it is the right thing to do. In other words, in the beginning, we do it because other people tell us, and we go along with them, and we have faith in that sense. Later, the faith is, if you like, rewarded, in the sense of it is now completely and absolutely the right thing, and there is no doubt that it is could ever have been different from the right thing. So the trees and mountains are again trees and mountains, but you should not think of them quite in the same way as the original trees and mountains. In the beginning, they only had the form of trees and mountains. Now they have the reality of trees and mountains, and there's quite a difference between those two. I'm sure you all know that whenever you have been told about something, it was totally different from experiencing it. That is exactly what I'm speaking of here. It is one thing to be told of God's love or the cosmic Buddha's love, and another to experience it. It is quite unbelievable and totally different from anything that one would ever dream of. So, if they who are unfortunate and lacking in virtue are unable to hear of these three treasures, how is it possible for them to take refuge therein? One must not go for refuge to mountain spirits and ghosts, nor must one worship in places of heresy, for such things are contrary to the truth. One must instead take refuge quickly in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, for therein is to be found utter enlightenment as well as freedom from suffering. The big danger for any person who really and truly tries to get into religion is that his original faith, which is a very exquisite and gentle thing, it is almost like a very delicate flower, is very much at the mercy of other people's theories and opinions. And it is very important for him, for a person, to not allow that very delicate thing to, as it were, be raped by other people's notions and ideas. If he or she has something that they know to be true within themselves, it is very dangerous to force that something into a mold because parents or teachers tell us to do so. It is an exquisite thing of itself, and it should be left in its original exquisite state. But it is extraordinarily difficult to do, especially when one is young, and there are so many things around to distract. One of the things that has often worried me with young people here on this campus, for example, and I have two of my monks presently studying languages here, is that it's a little bit like that ad you see on TV of the cat and the dog cuddling each other with all the ticks and fleas out there just waiting to jump on. I hate to say this about some of the influences that go around in the world at the present moment, but I do occasionally feel that young people are out there and there are all these ticks and fleas just waiting to suck the blood. I'm sure you understand my point on this, and therefore it is very important that a young person shall have the faith in the cosmic Buddha and hold it firm and still, because once he gets out there, in the influences of universities and work and the people he is with, it is very easy to have that beautiful thing raped. And it is never quite the same after that rape has taken place. Spiritual rape, to my mind, is perhaps the worst thing that can happen to a human being. Physical rape you can get over, but spiritual rape can take years and perhaps is never cured. Therefore, Dogen says, be very careful that you take refuge immediately in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and that you do not get caught up in people's private theories and private notions. Now, the only way you can avoid being caught up in such things is by completely and absolutely understanding the purpose of precepts, and it is not to give moral guidance. It has been turned into something that is not quite nice, but its purpose was not to be that. A pure heart, if one would take refuge, a pure heart is necessary if one would take refuge in the three treasures. At any time, whether during the Buddha's lifetime or after his demise, we should repeat the following with bowed head, making gashaw. I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. We take refuge in the Buddha since he is our true teacher. We take refuge in the Dharma since it is the medicine for all suffering. We take refuge in the Sangha since its members are wise and compassionate. If we would follow the Buddhist teachings, we must honor the three treasures. This foundation is absolutely essential before receiving the precept. A pure heart is one that is cleansed of karma. More of this later on. A heart cannot be pure unless every bit of karma has been cleansed. You note that I do not say expiated. There's a total difference between expiation and cleansing. By constantly trying to expiate what one has done, karma goes on unending. This is the danger of expiation. Cleansing karma is a totally different thing. I talked to you about this a couple of weeks ago, I think, when I made it very clear that to cleanse karma, one must not go around like a centipede with washcloths, constantly trying to wash the spot with every leg one has, because it can never be as if an act had not been committed. There will always have an act once done is an act done. Therefore, a heart that is pure is one that is cleansed of karma. And a person who is not going to get caught by all the notions and ideas and theories that people have that are running around is a person who trusts that which has always been true to him within himself, who goes to the scriptures for help, and who, when he is stuck, has enough discernment to find someone who can really and truly help him, who has not really got a stake in it for himself, so that he will be made use of rather than helped. Far too many people who try to give help or who want to give help do it for material gain. One of the beauties I have always felt of the Buddhist priesthood was that this was not allowed. Salaries were not permitted. I cannot help feeling that all priesthood should be the same as that. There should not be the possibility of material gain. Otherwise, sooner or later, it will become corrupted. That is just my private opinion, however. The merit of the three treasures bears fruit whenever a trainee and the Buddha are one. Whoever experiences this communion will invariably take refuge in the three treasures, irrespective of whether he is a god, demon, or an animal. As one goes from one stage of existence to another, the above-mentioned merit increases, leading eventually to the most perfect enlightenment. The Buddha himself gave certification to the great merit of the three treasures because of their extreme value and unbelievable profundity. It is essential that all living things shall take refuge therein. A lot of people feel that you only get merit as a result of acts that are seen or known. They do not realize that one of the greatest means of obtaining merit is to have absolute faith in the cosmic Buddha, to trust what the great and wise Buddhas and patriarchs have said, and to trust that there are people in this world good enough to help. The simple faith itself is one of the greatest means of obtaining merit known in the Buddhist world, because it is a completely alone act. By that I mean an act that one does solely by oneself without anyone else to help one. It is something that is done absolutely and completely. A taking refuge, a loving, a believing in, then this no greater merit can, from this more merit can come than from anything else known. The three pure collective precepts must be accepted after the three treasures. These are: cease from evil, do only good, and do good for others. Now, in the beginning, this is very, we take it again literally, on the same level that we take the three refuges. At a later date, you come back along this sort of passage again. You have a sort of thing that looks like this. You start from nothing at this end, and you go to nothing. You've got your three refuges here, about here you've got your three pure precepts, because you're trying to understand them. Here in the middle you've got your ten. Then you get back to your three pure precepts, having sorted it all out, and in the end you end up in just your three refuges. You're back to nothing again. You sort of fatten the thing out. This is, the trees are trees, then they aren't trees. You're sorting it all out in the middle, and then you get back to being trees are trees again. But the second time you hit it, it's not the same as the first. In both these cases, it is fairly simple to understand what it means to cease from evil, at least in theory. It's extraordinarily difficult when one tries to do it absolutely. Because there is always the possibility that if one person ceases from evil, another person will be helped, or will be hurt. Supposing, this after all is the basis of every soap opera on TV. Oh, I can't tell him, I might hurt him. I mustn't do that, somebody else might find out. And then what would happen? There is none of the realization that if one is in that place which is beyond good and evil, i.e. if one is sitting in the place of the Buddha, in the place of the Hara, then any act that is done from that place will be beyond good and evil. And if it is done from that place, although it may seem to have a rough effect on somebody else, if that person is also living in that place, it will not really have a rough effect upon him. You see, you only have soap opera when people are living in the world of the opposites. If I do something which I know is good for others, because I know that that is the only thing to do, but that from the soap opera point of view, it's going to create havoc in all directions, I have to be able to see beyond that soap opera, to know that the soap opera doesn't matter, and that in the real fundamental place, none of these people are going to be hurt. This is what makes the actions of a Zen master frequently seem quite freaky to the world. Doesn't he have any feelings for other people? It is because he has feelings for other people that he will not allow them to live in a soap opera type of world. He will not allow them to deceive themselves. And it is only by studying the 10 precepts with great care that you can discover what that really means, not to deceive oneself. We need to look at each of the 10 precepts in detail to understand how to get to the mind that lives beyond good and evil, and therefore can live beyond the soap opera, which is the normal cut-off level of sanity, and in between sanity and insanity, in which most of us live. One, do not kill. There is the obvious, do not kill. Don't go around killing things, don't make yourself coarse, don't make yourself lose your natural compassion. In other words, become a vegetarian, try not to tread on insects. Do not kill. That's the 10 precepts at that end of this nodule. Then you turn the stream of compassion within. As Dogen is always saying, turn the stream of compassion within. What is it that gets killed? You can take it on the moral level. People shouldn't kill each other. But the real purpose of not killing is the not doing damage to others and not doing damage to yourself. You see, the life did not come from you. You did not invent this life. It was given to you. This is not your private possession to do with whatsoever you wish. Life was given to you, and it was a great honor. It is extraordinarily rude, among other things, to throw it in the face of the cosmic Buddha and say, I don't want it. For a start, you can't do that. Monkey tries doing it in the film. He tries running to the ends of the earth and discovers that he has never got any further than the other end of the Buddha's hand. You can never get away from the cosmic Buddha. You can never get away. There is no escape. Therefore, any time you try to kill something, what you are really doing is killing yourself, killing part of yourself. You are destroying you. You are destroying your compassion. You are destroying your love. And above all, you are destroying your respect for life. And it is the respect for life which is the great crime here. So do not kill means simply have respect for that which comes from Buddha. Because you believe in the Buddha, have respect for that which comes from him. You have not the right to try and destroy that which is his. I am not the cosmic Buddha, and there is nothing in me that is not of the cosmic Buddha. Therefore, I may not attempt to destroy anything of this. And if I do make that attempt, then that which gets killed, that which gets hurt, is me. My compassion goes, my love goes, my feeling goes, my sanity goes, my wisdom goes, and above all, I lose my respect for life. And later, as you go through the Book of Life, you will also discover something else. You quite literally send out some of the essence of the Buddha that is in you and allow in just a little more delusion. And that can put stresses and strains on the body and help it to die just a little quicker. So you are always hurting yourself. Do not steal. I'm sure some of you, at some time or other, have met a person who either cheated on an examination, or took drugs, or did something similar. By cheating on the examination, they could never be sure that they would have passed it. So who is stolen from? Certainly not the examining authorities. The stealing has been from oneself. One steals one's own certainty. One steals one's own peace of mind. One takes it away. It is when you hit this point, which is roughly the midpoint of the 10 precepts, that real sanity starts to set in. What is written here in the Shōbō Genzō is the end, is the left side of this nodule. What I am talking of now is the middle of this nodule. What hits at this end here of it is what is spoken of in the Kyōjū Kaimon, which is to take the precepts further still. How does one damage oneself with the rest of the 10? Let's look at them. Do not covet. In other words, don't burn yourself up with desire for things. Do not steal your own peace of mind. Do not damage yourself. Fourth one, do not say that which is untrue. Do not overtax your memory by constantly having to remember what you said last time. You have got far too much to do with it to waste so valuable a product. Do not waste time with these things. Tell the truth at all times. Do not make yourself have no peace of mind. Do not waste your brain substance. Or what did I tell so-and-so? I know what I told her. What did I tell him? I got to get it right. What a waste of time. You're spending 5 or 10 minutes worrying about this when you could be spending that 5 or 10 minutes enjoying the love of the cosmic Buddha, just sitting there and thoroughly enjoying it. You get so much more spare time when you keep the precepts. This is the thing that people don't seem to realize. If you really keep them, the amount of spare time and peace and quiet is incredible. But you do not understand the importance of doing it until you hit that midpoint. Because you've heard of all these things, oh, you mustn't do that, dear, you mustn't do this, dear, when you were young. And morality, as it was so called, has been a big bugaboo. But it is not a bugaboo. It is only because nobody has taught you what is really going on in keeping precepts. Let's look at the next one. Do not sell the wine of delusion. That's a beauty. You know, people get their own private opinions. In the beginning, they're just private theories. And later, they decide, yes, I gotta be right. And so they become stuck with those opinions, and then they try forcing those opinions on other people without ever having checked them out completely and carefully in meditation. And so they no longer know really what truth is. And this can hide the cosmic Buddha from one faster than anything else. But what's even worse is that they're trying to get other people to join that opinion. And that is extraordinarily dangerous. Do not allow other people to take over your mind. Do not sell the wine of delusion. Do not allow others to take over your mind, and do not try to take over other people's. Thus the Buddha very wisely said, don't believe anything I'm saying, and you mustn't believe anything I'm saying. I'm not here proselytizing. I'm saying, check everything out. There's a big difference. Do not allow people to sell you a bill of goods unless every single part of you knows that it is the right thing to do. The Buddha was very wise when he said, check every single thing. But don't close your mind to it either. As I have pointed out to my monks on many occasions, I have a sort of back burner in my skull, on which anything that I didn't completely believe that my master told me, I sat it, sort of cooked quietly, and if it ever got proved true, that was fine. I did not say, you're wrong. I said, well, I don't terribly much believe it right now, but maybe in 10 years' time, who knows, when I'm as old as you are, I'll have got a bit more sense, or maybe I'll have had some experience and it'll prove right. So do not turn everybody's theories away. But do not allow them to take over your mind until you know that they are completely and absolutely right. That is the big difference between selling the wine of delusion and discussing things sensibly and sanely with other people.
Right.
Do not speak against others. Obviously, a person who speaks against others can't be trusted. All you manage to do if you start that is you lose friends because nobody wants to be with you. So you automatically cut yourself off from some of the better means of taking refuge in the Sangha of the human race. Some of these are fairly obvious, others aren't. Do not be proud of yourself and devalue others, because you know damn well somebody will start devaluing you. You try it. So who again gets hurt? You. You have to turn the stream of compassion within. That is the point. This is the turning point of the stream of compassion entering the center of this nodule. Do not be mean in giving either dharma or wealth. If people need help, don't be afraid of giving it and be willing to give it. Do not be such a fool that you give everything and you've got no means of looking after yourself, and then you're complaining about the fact, well, I did all this for him and all that for her, and look at the state I'm in now and nobody cares. Don't land yourself in that sort of a hole. But if you have that which you can give at a sane level, do so. By so doing, you will retain your friends, you will also retain their respect, and you will also retain your own sanity. Do not debase the three treasures. This is a popular one, or it was at any rate in my youth, when it was fashionable to sneer about anything religious, to sneer about God, to sneer about what went on in churches. It doesn't matter whether something that goes on in another church is what you agree with or what you do not agree with. They are entitled to their opinions and you are entitled to yours. Since all churches, all gods, all religions are an attempt to express the truth, and since one of the purposes of this course is to show you how the basic religious experience which the Christians call the spiritual marriage and Zen calls Kensho, are identical, since the purpose of this is to show you that the effects are exactly the same. Be very careful that you do not go around debasing other forms of the cosmic Buddha. There's a piece in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom in which I'm talking about all the cardboard shapes of the various, I can't remember what chapter it is, of the various gods, and there are people coming by and they're bowing it to some and spitting at others and turning their backs on others and thumbing their noses at others, and one they are worshipping magnificently. And in the vision I had, I went behind them, and they were just cardboard facades, all beautifully covered in gold. And there was a sort of stream of pieces of cardboard that went up into a cloud, all being held by something with a hand here. And there was a roar of laughter coming out of the cloud, because it didn't matter whether you were bowing or spitting or doing what. It was all the same thing that was being bowed and spat at. So if you won't spit, if you don't like me in this form, you'll like me in this one. I've still got you. It's a very important point. Do not worry about what it looks like externally. And above all, do not debase the three treasures, no matter what form they come in. It does not matter what form they come in. Only if you have this sort of respect and love and understanding will the thing become real, and will the treasure house open naturally. And this is the center pivot, the turning of the spirit within, that hits right in the middle of this. Then you can start going down the other side and seeing the ten precepts in a somewhat different light. Example, you can take it to the Kyoju Kaimon, which I've asked you to do in some depth, which is on page 266 and 267. Do not kill, but no life can be cut off, for the life of Buddha is increasing. Continue the life of Buddha. Do not kill Buddha. Do not turn against yourself. Do not hurt yourself. Who would want to hurt themselves under these circumstances? But you had to know who Buddha was. You had to know, in other words, who was really getting hurt before you could do something about it. You had to stop thinking of precepts as a morality that was set there to keep you in order, that had something to do with hats and white gloves and black patent shoes on Sunday when I was young. It was extraordinarily easy for my generation, I've told this to his many times, for my generation to rebel. All you had to do was flatly refuse to wear hats and gloves. And it worked wonders. The entire country was falling apart. Nowadays, you need to do the most terrible things to rebel. But it was very easy when I was young. Very easy indeed. It was just as much of a statement and a lot safer than what goes on now. But it was very, very easy. You do not have to do that sort of rebellion. What you have to know is what the purpose of preceptual teaching was. And it was to teach you how not to hurt yourself, how to turn the stream of compassion within. And then you could really see what the meaning of precepts was, and how they not only helped self, in the end they helped other, and they kept the entire nation or community clean and beautiful and worth knowing. You get more than happiness out of this. After all, as I've said before, a dog asleep in the sun is happy. Who wants that? Out of this comes ecstasy and peace of mind. A peace of mind that is quite unbelievable. You have to experience it to know it. You see, you can get it to the state of this set of precepts, which is what I want you to study in detail for next week. Let me go back to page 157. 158, I'm sorry. All the Buddhas have received and carefully preserved the above three treasures, the three pure collective precepts, and the 10 precepts. If you accept these precepts wholeheartedly, the highest enlightenment will be yours. So remember, the state here is totally different from the state there. You are, as it were, inside out. One end to the other. You have changed the outlook completely. You have put the camera in focus and seen what is the purpose of this. And this is the undestroyable Buddhahood which was understood and is understood in the past, present, and future. Is it possible that any truly wise person would refuse the opportunity to attain to such heights? Some do, but they are not truly wise. The Buddha has clearly pointed out to all living beings that whenever these precepts are truly accepted, that means in all their forms, not just given lip service at this end of it, but all the way, when they are truly accepted, Buddhahood is reached. Every person who accepts them becoming the one and only true child of the Buddha. You are the heir. But you have to go the whole way. And you can be the heir in this life. You do not have to wait until death. And you can know that you are the heir. And that everybody else around you is the one and only heir. I say the one and only because the cosmic Buddha does not have favorites. And he does not give himself just partially to one and more to another. When he gives absolutely to everyone. Everyone inheriting the same amount. In that sense, you are the one and only heir. And it doesn't matter whether what color you are, it doesn't matter what sex you are, it doesn't matter what sexual orientation you have. The cosmic Buddha does not care about these things. They come under opposites. They come under differences. What he cares about is that which is right inside beyond all these differences. He cares about that which makes you tick, that which animates you, that which gives you life, that which is shared by every single being in this room and in this world. And that is what makes you the heir of the Buddha. Within these precepts dwell the Buddhas, enfolding all things within their unparalleled wisdom. It is nice to note that the Buddhas live within those precepts. And the more you come along, the more you begin to see them. You don't really see much until you hit the middle stage, until you turn the stream of compassion within, and then you start seeing a tremendous amount. There is no distinction between subject and object for any who dwell herein. All things, earth, trees, wooden posts, bricks, stones, become Buddhas. Once this refuge is taken, from these precepts come forth such a wind and fire that all are driven into enlightenment when the flames are fanned by the Buddha's influence. This is the merit of non-action and non-seeking, the awakening to true wisdom. From these precepts come forth such a wind and fire. Where's our friend who's interested in the secret of the golden flower? Is he here today? No, that's a pity. Some of you have been reading the Hui Ming Ching. How many of you have read The Secret of the Golden Flower? Yes. There is a part of that which speaks of this, how the wind and fire drives one into enlightenment. And when the precepts are truly and absolutely accepted, there really does seem to appear a wind that fans the flames. You remember I said that in the beginning you play with fire and later the fire plays with you. When you truly accept the precepts is the moment when the fire starts to play with you. Once you truly accept them, once you really turn inside and start doing something about this, you can no more stop this process than you could stop an express train with a sore thumb. And it would be about as stupid to try. So once you really get into that stage, the cosmic Buddha, in the beginning you say, you know, it's like two people getting married. He says, I do. The girl says, I do. The parson says, you bet you do. You're hitched. In the beginning, what's happened is you said, yes, I do. And the cosmic Buddha says, oh, yeah. And then suddenly you hit the middle point and he says, you bet you do. You've had it. And you're taken from then on. And there is no way back. So don't hit that midpoint of turning the stream of compassion within if you do not want to be grabbed by the cosmic Buddha. Two people from England turned up in Sojiji. This was many years ago when I was studying there. And they were telling the chief abbot, Kōhō Zenji, all the wonderful things that they were doing and how they were meditating and how they got this master and that master. And the old man, who did some rather unseemly things for an archbishop and an imperial teacher occasionally, sort of stretched like this on his gorgeous cushions, and you saw some of his underclothes as he did it, said, you know, do you realize that anyone who meditates runs the risk of being grabbed by the cosmic Buddha? Are you willing for that? And the two were horrified because they'd never heard of a cosmic Buddha. There couldn't be a cosmic Buddha. What was this cosmic Buddha he was talking about? And they weren't going to be grabbed. They were going to be in control of it. And the old man looked at me, sighed, and said, take them and show them the temple, which effectively meant get them out of here and don't bug me with them. It was a great pity. If they had been a little more serious, they would have heard a quite incredible sermon, had very remarkable teaching. I had seen him in that state only once or twice. They were very foolish. But there did have to be the acceptance of the fact that there was something greater than their own personal egos. And that that thing was what was going to grab them. Thing, it, she, the unborn, the uncreated, the undying. It was going to take them. And if they meditated, they were beckoning to it. Come on, I'm willing. And when you hit that midpoint, you said, I really am willing. And the cosmic Buddha says, you bet you are. And you've had it from the point of your worldliness for the rest of your life. So don't hit that point if you don't want to be taken. From it comes forth such a wind and fire that all are born into enlightenment and fanned into enlightenment when this point is, when they are truly taken. This is the merit of non-action and non-seeking. This is what is talked about in the scriptures that we shall be doing at the next lecture. This is the place of non-action and non-seeking, the place of sitting still, the place of finding the moon in the earth. This is the place where it all truly begins. Up until then, you've been, it's all right, you're sort of a, that's not the right term, how can I do this? You've been going through the motions. After that, the motions go through you. And you are taken by them. Right. Now, this is just something that comes as a bonus as a result of doing this. The more one cleans up the karma, the more one removes the stresses and strains that are on various physical parts of the body. I asked you to read part 2 of the Book of Life some time back. I want you to do it again now, because I want you to understand, part of it's in my section, isn't it, as well? I think so, yes. I want you to understand clearly how various breakages of the precepts will affect your body physically. Everybody knows that ulcers come from worry. What causes worry? All sorts of things can. If you've chopped up your mother-in-law and put her in the cellar, I would imagine you'd worry quite a bit. What people do not realize is that every single physical organ can have something go wrong with it as a result of some of the things that it is best we did not do. A person who is constantly feeling insecure, for example, can have things go wrong with the pancreas and can eventually get diabetes if the insecurity becomes incredibly great. Buddhism has proved this throughout the ages. Various other illnesses can hit various other parts of the body. I do not need to waste your time talking about it. It's all in the Book of Life. Do not think that only your stomach and your intestines are going to be messed up if you worry. You can mess up every part of your body by not keeping the precepts. The reason is not because somebody, as I said earlier, is trying to put morality on you from the outside, but simply because you are not being compassionate to you. You are causing yourself worry. You are causing yourself fear. If you are constantly fearful, you will eventually end up with problems in your kidneys. If you are constantly despairing, you will frequently end up with problems in your kidneys. Each organ can be damaged by not keeping the precepts accurately and correctly. So in the end, who really gets hurt by going along with, oh, I mustn't hurt this or I mustn't hurt that one because, well, if I do the right thing, look what is going to happen. Who in the end gets hurt? You. And so do they. I'm sure you've noticed that people whom you've not told the truth to because you felt it would hurt them have frequently been hurt a lot more than if you'd come right out and said it in the beginning. It takes a lot of courage to live completely by the precepts. But unless you're going to do that completely and absolutely, you're going to get badly, badly hurt. And in the end, you will put stresses and strains on your body that will cause it to die. So in that sense, you do kill yourself, and then you're breaking the precepts. You're killing Buddha. Do not kill. Do not do that which will cause you to kill yourself and will cause Buddha to die. And this is the meaning of keeping the precepts. Whew. Okay, who's got some questions? Yes, go ahead.
I was reading in a book called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, which is a college course book.
I haven't read it, I should tell you that, okay? Yes.
Well, they say that the Puritans went secular in a sense, the Puritan ethic went secular when people started to feel that their spiritual future was indicated by their present circumstances. Therefore, you're saved if you're, for example, successful in this life. And so
that's a right one. Sorry, go on.
The effort went into being successful.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if something the same might happen here. Wouldn't it be easy to say to yourself, I have bad health, that means I'm a sinner, I must extend my bodily function and improve it, and so on. And then your effort might
There are pitfalls every step of the journey. But I think the way in which I have always done it, and I've always warned people to do it, is first and foremost, love the cosmic Buddha. Don't do anything because you want it for you. Do it because you just want to be with him or her or it for eternity. If you do it from that point of view, somehow or other, you don't make mistakes.
Well, you can't really judge where someone's at spiritually by their physical condition.
Oh, no. No sign of it. You see, there is also the fact that somebody may get better as a result of having done a lot of meditation is a minor bonus. He may not start meditating until his body is so badly deteriorated there just isn't a way back for it physically. And I have this interesting thing that I've inherited from my father, which is I collect water by just looking at it. And I carry around about 60 or 80 extra pounds of it. I've not sinned so that I collect water. My father happened to suffer from a disease which I've inherited, so fair enough. I don't feel wicked. No, that is no point of it. But the fact remains that as a result of cleaning things up, it is just possible you might get a quite incredible bonus. I certainly had two very good bonuses. One was I got rid of my heart trouble. The second, I got rid of my high blood pressure. Well, I got three. I also don't catch cold any longer. But I didn't get rid of my dad's illness. That's fair enough. I'm happy with those three. You always get something for a bonus, but you can't do it to get the bonus. And the person who would be doing that would be somebody who was saying, well, I must clean up in order to become healthy because otherwise I'm sinning. No. That's saying I want the bonus because that's the sign of not sinning. What he's first got to do is not sin. Can I take this first, our friend here?
Could you elaborate on the saying, when you meet the Buddha, kill him? Does that come under number five?
No. No, no. That, unfortunately, is not quite what is meant by the term when you meet the Buddha, kill him.
I have my own ideas for it.
No, what it really means is if something is being forced on you, which is called the Buddha, this is the one and only right way, and everything in you knows that it is wrong, then you must not follow that way, even if it looks as though you're killing the Buddha.
And so, The same thing says that if you meet a patriarch, kill him.
If you find somebody...
It can never always be wrong or right or...
Yes. If you get somebody who's putting his trip on you, to use the vernacular, and insisting he's the one and only that's right, and that you've got to follow him absolutely, and not consider anything for yourself, then this is no true master. And kill it is... It's unfortunate they use the term kill. What it really means is... pay no attention to, discard, get rid of, because this is untrue. In that sense, you must not follow false teaching.
Or imitate.
Or, yes. If somebody gets in your way to that extent that he does not allow you to develop in your true way, he is no Buddha and he is no patriarch.
Well, in other words, if you read something that the patriarch writes and you say, well, that's not for me, can you say anything like that?
Yes, you can, but you have to say it in this sense. It is not for me now. I do not believe this at this time, but I will not discard it absolutely. I'll sort of set it aside, and maybe 10, 15, 20 years it'll be proved right, and maybe it never will be. There are a couple of things still in my head that my master told me that I have not proved true, and I've never taught them to anybody in consequence. There were three up to a week ago. I had one proved true last week, quite by accident. And it was the one I didn't expect to ever have proved true, but that's neither here nor there. So yes, you do have things. You should have things like that. It means you've not given your mind over to somebody else on a platter and said, here, turn it into head cheese or whatever you want to with it, which is what some people do nowadays.
Some people insist that teachers
they try
take
to
it over. They'll try to make a teacher into a savior.
I lost several monks in Shasta because I refused to take them over. They wanted to be taken over. And I said, no. There's one very good reason, apart from the obvious, there's one very good reason. Since no one can sustain being God for longer than it takes to go from one use of the toilet to the next, to put it politely, since no one can sustain it beyond that time, it is extraordinarily dangerous to allow people to think that you are God. They get very upset when they discover you are not. Yes, go ahead.
As you were talking just now, this is an aside from what I was going to say, but it occurred to me that is what happened to Christ.
Yes.
He was taken over, and from my readings,
I couldn't agree with you more. Yes.
Do not, and it occurred the disciples after he died insisted on.
I can remember asking Kohan Zenji once. Because I knew he didn't drink, and I asked him why he very occasionally drank. And he said, it is very important that my disciples know that I have clay feet, that I am not God. And it will be very important to yours to know that you are not God. And I've banged this in their heads so often. I will not let people sit me up here on this pedestal, and the instant everything goes wrong, they go out and they get sixpenny worth of balls from the nearest hoopla and start shying at me. I'm not going to let that happen.
She told us this story about the Indians that pray to a totem pole, and when things don't go right, they chop it down.
Yeah.
And this is what happens.
They have a war, they dance around their totem pole and they worship it, and then when they lose the war, they go out and they make a fire of it. I don't intend to be made a fire of.
It says a pure heart is necessary if one would take refuge.
Yes.
There are very few Buddhists. How can one take refuge if one, since most of us do not have this pure heart?
They do eventually.
I feel that you can.
Yes. You do eventually.
But you can't even if you're not yet.
Well, you're always Buddha in one sense. Just you don't know it yet.
I guess I need to know what it's to ask you to define the term take refuge.
To love absolutely is to take refuge. If you love absolutely, you do that which the Buddha does. Oh, very much so.
Yeah, but that, what I'm saying is that what we're doing when our religious searches is attempting to get...
You're trying to find the way in. And this is why I first wrote the title I did of the book that I wrote, Selling Water by the River. Everybody was walking along by the river and saying, I'm thirsty, where's the water? So I sold water right by the river. I wasn't being sarcastic, I was telling them the truth. Here's a doorway in. And what most people are doing in religions is groping around the door and saying, where's the handle, where's the handle? And this is what Zen means by the gateless gate. The door isn't there anyway, so just go on walking in. Why are you looking for a handle to a door that isn't there? There's just an archway. Just go straight through it. Don't grope around looking for the handle in. Yeah.
We talked earlier about teaching and working with kids and basically being with people. Is I feel you really can't change anyone. The only thing you can do is offer your training, but not change anybody. I mean, it's...
You don't get rid of anything and you don't alter anything. You have to learn how to look at things. Sometime next week, I shall be talking about four signs of enlightenment, one of which is sympathy. And it becomes a true sign of enlightenment when you see it through the eyes of other rather than through the eyes of self. Now, the situation is identically the same, but you are able to objectivize it. And this is also true with anger and all the other things. When you can objectivize anger, you can have compassion for the other person. And that is how you transform it. You don't throw the anger away. You convert it. And that is what you have to do with children and other people. You have to see them as yourself. You have to see it through their eyes. You have to hear where they are coming from. If you judge by what a person does without hearing where he or she is coming from, it's a totally different situation. I can give you a case in point from me. Somebody was very concerned up in Shasta because I sort of jump every time lightning flashes. Well, you see, they are young. They've not seen an air raid. I was in England during all the big air raids. Now, a person who's only seen a thunderstorm knows that if they see the flash, the thunder doesn't matter because it's all over. But when I was young, if you saw the flash, it meant you were probably going up in smoke. And the connection between the two is still very strong in my mind. Now, I can meditate through a thunderstorm, but the connection is still there. Now, if you judge me because I jump every time it flashes, you are not hearing where I am coming from. And you're saying, oh, well, how can she be a Zen master? How can she be this or that? I mean, she jumps every time it flashes with lightning. My old karma still works on me. Remember what I said about the way in which old karma can still work on you? Yeah, I still remember running and hiding when I was 15 and 16 years old, with Hitler dropping bombs on me and saying, if this is welcome to the adult world, my God, what hit me? Do you see what I'm saying? To be able to sympathize, to be able to get into where another person is, and not just judge by the externals, hear why he is in that place and not judge him because he is in it. Because nobody knows why he is in it. It's a very different situation. Yes, go ahead.
This is going to seem like a very elementary question, but it's very important to me. Why is it necessary to meditate? Why is that the way in?
Because I don't know of any other.
Well, keeping the precepts is surely part of it too, isn't it? I mean,
well, in one sense, any time a person tries to do the right thing, they meditate. They don't realize it. You see, you tend to think, or a lot of people tend to think of meditation as something like packing yourself up as a pretzel, sitting in a certain way, looking at a certain thing. But any time a person really tries to do good, they have put themselves, you know, just as you put a car in park, they put themselves in meditation gear. So don't get stuck, which is what Dogen automatically says. Don't cling to sitting. Don't cling to lying down. After a bit, if you're really trying to do the right thing, you're meditating anyway. But you do need the peace and quiet of just sitting every now and then in order to be able to think things out, and eventually just to sit for the joy of sitting, because your body just loves it. It's being one with the cosmic Buddha. So you really can't get away from meditation if you try to do the right thing, is what I'm saying.
There's nothing wrong with working things out then. As I always fight it so much when I sit there to try to watch the thoughts, you know, and not get caught in them. And I always get caught in them.
Don't worry. If it's any comfort, I got caught in them for the first 10 years. That help?
It's important to realize that it's that there is a perfectly good time for deliberate thought. And deliberate thought is not something we're trying to rid ourselves of, but we just want to learn to be able not to be totally controlled by it. Because when Meditation is simply learning to be in touch with something beneath all that, which is, you can do that in many different ways, but most people have difficulty when things get rough. They're just totally, they can't do it. They get completely pulled out of their own center. And the idea of disciplining yourself to do this every day gets you more and more and more in contact with it, so that when you really need to be there, you know how. That's really all it is.
And it can do some quite remarkable things, because I have not been terribly well all day, and I suggested I didn't come and lecture. But you see, if you really got good at meditation, there's a place where you can lecture from, which is below or above, whichever way you like to look at it, that physical state, which is rather a nice place to have. Can I take this one first? Go ahead.
In the Christian tradition, you know, we don't seem to stress meditation, but is prayer or trying to do the right thing for a Christian, would that get
prayer, as far as I'm concerned, prayer, as far as I'm concerned, if it's properly done, is identically the same thing as meditation. I've been having an interesting correspondence with some monks, Cistercian monks at St. Bernard's Abbey in England. And we've come to the conclusion that properly done prayer is identically the same as properly done meditation.
What would properly done be?
Properly done prayer is just loving God with everything in one's being.
Love the Lord thy God.
With all thy mind, with all thy soul, and with all thy strength. And thy neighbor as thyself. That's the bit too many forget. I had a landlady when I was at university who forgot that. Oh, I can't have you students in. I was at London University. We can't have you students in during Holy Week. It will damage our prayers for Holy Week. So we all got sinus trouble in the great smog of 54. I hate to think what sort of merit she got for that particular Holy Week. It's very important to remember the last bit. No, just love the Lord thy God with all thy soul and with all thy strength. Thy neighbor as thyself, which is one of the signs of enlightenment. To see through another's eyes, to be able to sympathize, to empathize completely and absolutely. There's a piece on this next chapter, which we've got for next week. To identify oneself with that which is not oneself is to be able to understand the true meaning of sympathy. Take, for example, the fact that the Buddha appeared in the human world in the form of a human being. Sympathy does not distinguish between oneself and others. That is identically the same as that Christ came down in the form of a man. The Buddha appeared in the form of a human being. Thy neighbor as thyself. Too many people take God for granted and that he'll do the neighbor job as well. But the ones who have to do the neighbor job is us. Yeah. You had a question, my friend.
I have three questions.
Go ahead.
First is leading right into the sympathy. When you're talking about seeing something through the eyes of others, mm-hmm. And you also said that nobody knows that person's reasons or story except themselves. You're not talking about magic, you're talking about an attitude and a willingness.
A willingness to not judge him for being the way he is. Because there is probably a good reason for it. A very good reason for it.
Two is, I really like the title, Selling Water by the River, and I was wondering...
Well, it wasn't the original title of the book. And the person who asked me to change it to something else did so for all the wrong reasons. It was one of the editors of Pantheon. And they felt that this would bring in more money and everything. And he went, eek. Because I really wasn't in the business for money. I just wanted people to have the joy of reading Dogen's teachings. And to hear it put that blatantly, and that, if I may coin an adjective, New York like New Yorkly worried me.
But it happened anyway because it was a clearer.
Well, they wouldn't publish it if I didn't. And I wanted it out. As it was, they altered a tremendous amount of the manuscript, which I didn't find out until several years later. I kept looking. I got the only copy I got of the original. I kept looking and saying, I didn't really write it quite like that, did I? And it wasn't until I got it back that I realized that they'd done a fair amount of editing so that Dogen came out slightly askew is the only word I can put for it, I can give for it, you know. It was like looking at truth round a corner instead of along a straight road. That worried me a lot, because I'd spent a lot of years and a lot of time, and so had a lot of very important monks in the Far East, including two of the chief scholars of Zen, in getting it right. And we did not do that for some little tin-pot editor in New York to come along with a red pencil. We did it because we were trying to get the best translation out possible. Go ahead.
On meditation, so I can get it straight in my mind. In meditation, you don't sit down and solve out daily problems.
You just sit still.
You should just let your mind go more or less blank, or try to focus in the direction of thinking of God or thinking of God.
Don't try to make it think of anything. Try to get to that state where there is the unborn, the undying, and the uncreated, which is below thought. Thoughts are going to come and go. You'll never know when you are in that place, but you will always know when you are not. So what you do is you just sit in meditation, and thoughts come and go. Don't grab at them, and don't try pushing them away. Just sit there still. And this beautiful, peaceful feeling throughout the body and mind. And just note that thoughts come and that they go. Now, the real problem with meditation is you never really completely know until you hit this midpoint if you're doing it right or not, which is really why you need a teacher. But in fact, you don't need a teacher if you've got the faith to go on the whole way. Does that help you? I mean, I'm contradicting myself every time, but I think you know what I'm saying.
The other question I had was on the subject of killing.
Yeah.
And you've also brought up the idea of being a vegetarian a couple of times. And I believe
that's for me.
Well, in killing, is killing animals taboo?
For me, it would be. But each person has to solve that particular problem for themselves. For me, it would be absolutely wrong. But you have to go search your own heart and know if it is right for you.
Because I was wondering about the rationale that people use in, you know, the argument of killing an animal as opposed to killing a tree.
Yes, I agree with you. The way I have worked it out for me, if this is of any help, but this is only for me, is that I have to eat in order to live. Therefore, I have to boil cabbages alive and do various other things. Now, have I done enough in this day to warrant the killing of anything? And if I must kill, have I done as little harm as possible? Have I caused as little pain as possible? And the scripture that you recite when you eat food really points this up. We must think deeply of the ways and means by which this food has come. We must consider our merit, our worthiness, when we accept it. We will eat so that we do not become lean and die, and so that we may be able to search for enlightenment. And that is the purpose for staying alive. So you do as little damage as you can. But yes, you have to accept the fact that you are doing some damage. You can never live without making some karma, but you make as little as you possibly can. That is my way of doing it.
I have a comment I'd like to make on this, is this is something I feel rather strongly about, and that is that it's very important not to try to step outside yourself and put some sort of external yardstick on right and wrong, yeah, because it doesn't work that way. It comes from inside. And if you look at it from an internal point of view, there's a rather obvious way of understanding why you make a cutoff line somewhere. I mean, most people understand they just cannot kill themselves, and they cannot kill their parents or their brothers and sisters, their family. They cannot kill other members of the human race. And as it gets further away from yourself, it gets a little harder to see it. But we manage to get it further and further out away from yourself. And that which is closer to you, you have more empathy with, or sympathy in the real sense. So it comes back to do not kill Buddha. And eventually it comes to the point of animals. They are sentient beings in a way we can empathize with very clearly. We can see their pain and their suffering. We can understand them on a very deep level if we open ourselves up to them. And then to kill them becomes an act of killing Buddha. Now we may have to, we still have to eat, and yet the fact remains that it doesn't have the same effect on us inside when we're vegetarians as it does when we're not. It coarsens oneself to eat meat. It's just sort of a fact. And at some point you've got to draw the line, and that's why we do it.
One can get so deeply into meditation that you can feel the pain, for example, in the metal of the cars as they're forced to drive up and down the roads. I've done that. But if you're to live in the world of man, you have to coarsen yourself to a certain extent, or you just cannot go on living. You can get very, very far in if you work at it.
If you're aware of those things, aren't you then selling yourself out by compromising the position of accepting, living in a position like that rather than going off and not putting up with it?
What can I do? Supposing I went off, I could not let people know that they do not have to be this way. Yes. Maybe I'm selling myself a bit short.
I wasn't.
No, I know you're not saying that. But I'm saying, yes, I've got to look at it from all these angles. Where can I do the most good? My purpose is to cease from evil and do only good, and do good for others. Where can I do the most good? I could do the most good for me, quite definitely, sitting up a mountain in a cave, which is my instinct. But that is not the thing to do. I have two other things to do. I must cease from evil. I could be doing evil by sitting up that cave, because somebody else who could benefit from hearing what not to do wouldn't hear it. By retiring from life, I could be doing evil. I was given life to live, not to run away from.
This
is something in this point. One thing in our training, some of us find hard to deal with at first, and maybe even later on. One of the aspects is all acceptance, and part of that all acceptance is you're accepting the fact that you're a human being, with all of the ramifications of that. In this life, you'll never reach perfection, whatever you think that might be. And until you can accept that, you're not going to be able to sit still. That is part of dealing.
Precepts are also a rule of thumb leading to something. As this points out, the precept against killing brings you to an understanding of something. But there is a momentum in training which is gained, and it is not subject to petty rules. I mean, and I don't mean to try to belittle the precepts. What I'm saying is that you can eat meat and not violate the rule. There are times when that happens. If meat is offered to you, you then...
By someone who
doesn't know, and you refuse it, you are then breaking a precept. It is of
greater... An animal died in vain.
Right. It's of greater value to accept the food and use it in a positive way. So these are not hard and fast rules, it becomes of greater benefit to join life rather than retreat from it.
There's a Japanese saying, Kokoro Kanashiku, the great grief. The great grief that although we can know perfection and could enter perfection in this world, it is not possible to do so, because if we did so, then we could break the three pure precepts. And we will be attempting to become God. We can know God, we can know that we are of God. But to attempt to become perfect is to attempt to be God. And Kokoro Kanashiku is that one has to accept this situation, the great grief. It took me many years to understand the Kokoro Kanashiku. And it really is a very great grief.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Just when we were talking about sympathy just now, you can only really know sympathy by that humanity.
Yes.
And it is,
you can't sympathize or empathize with somebody who's a god. All you can do is say, wow, isn't it wonderful? Mm-hmm. And dust it every now and then. And when it shows cracks, throw it away and get a new one.
Years ago, I was reading the Bible, and I read this excerpt, which is perhaps the most powerful thing I've ever read. It said, "He who is without sin cast the first stone." And it was like I realized it was not a thought or an action, or at least a thought in any realm of what anybody did, that I had not touched that. And it was even that aspect of Hitler, and it just really,
yes.
I think that.
Yes. There is not one of us that is without sin.
One thing that I found for myself was that the only way I could follow a teacher is if the teacher was human and imperfect. Otherwise, what type of example is it for me to follow? If the teacher is perfect, there is no example for me at all. It's only training in humanity that makes it possible for me to follow a teacher. It's something that it really almost thunderstruck me when I realized that.
I've lost two disciples in my life to the fact that I wasn't perfect. And all I can say is I'm extraordinarily sorry for the people they've gone to. That's all I can say about it.
I'd like to ask you, of course, if you don't
mind. Go ahead.
I've had some experience with Hindu tradition. And you know, we've had quite a few years, and we're taught to troubled me, and yet I felt that I should feel that way.
This is one of the reasons. This is one of the reasons that Buddhism came out of Hinduism. The Buddha said this was wrong. Mm-hmm. And therefore it is an outgrowth of Hinduism in that sense. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about the original reason I came.
Yeah.
And it came to me that I had come so that I could live my life for myself.
Yes.
That I had gotten out of touch with myself. That I had an absolute thirst to
get back to it.
Absolutely. And when you were speaking, you read the passage of the fire case. I felt absolutely terrified. I don't wish to be taken right now. You know, the thought of being meditating and getting in touch with my center, and then being carried with the milieu on beyond the life that I know.
Don't worry, it's worth it.
Then that could be, but it's still not right timing. It's not right timing. At least to me, yeah, it's not right timing.
Fine. that's fine.
The Buddha is a very sensible.
And very sensitive. Very sensitive. He will not take people before they're ready, interestingly enough. You can't hurt yourself with this. That's the exquisite beauty of it. It doesn't. That's why I said in the earlier stages tonight, it doesn't rape you. Rinzai Zen can rape you if you're not careful. It can rape your spirit. Soto can't. It lets you do it at your own speed. And that's one of its exquisite beauties. It sometimes lets people do it so much at their own speed that they don't seem to be doing a thing. Well, there's not much you can do about that. But one does presume that one is serious enough to be doing something.
Mm-hmm. This is sort of serious. I found a snail today, and I was aware that it was alive, and I threw it. And now, it sounds silly, you know, but if I put a snail in the middle of a concrete pavement, it will die before it reaches.
Because it's so you mess up its lubrication system.
Absolutely. If I let him chew up my food, I mean, I will not have any basil left. I just...
What are you doing this
now? Once you become aware, it's like once you...
It makes life difficult once you become aware, doesn't it? You have to be very careful once you become aware.
I was thinking of mites the other day, and same thing with the roses, putting nicotine on them. And I have a real problem. Because
the cosmic Buddha is having a wonderful time with you. I understand the problem. The tragedy is that I can't give you an answer because I am not God. You have to find the answer that is right for you. I can tell you that if you take life, then you are killing and you will take the consequences of that. And if you do not take life, you will take the consequences of that. That much I can tell you. So one has to stay still in the place beneath that and find what is the right thing to do. Ask the questions in the place beneath the waves, the palace beneath the waves, says the old saying.
It sounds ridiculous.
Well, if it's any comfort, I'll tell you what we do with rattlesnakes up in Shasta. We keep a sort of set of old tin boxes and old tin waste paper baskets, and we catch them and we put them on a mountain that nobody climbs. Nobody ever goes up Black Butte. It's a sort of mound of shale. Must be an awful lot of them up there. But it's the best thing you can do that I know of.
You actually take them to the top or close?
No, we just put them where they're not going to get killed.
Yeah.
Go off in a temper and haven't been moved out. Anyway, yes, go ahead.
This is along the same line with snails. I was living in a horse barn that had this apartment. And there were mice. And they were driving me bananas. And I finally decided, well, you know, I don't care what my reasoning is, I'm going to get mousetraps to take care of these mice. And then there was this one mouse. I didn't have the courage to deal with the mousetrap. And I knew that this mouse had gotten caught in all day to die, and it stirred me so much that I couldn't do
Yes, it's very worrying when the cosmic Buddha rubs it in, isn't it?
Yes. So,
yes.
I got cats because I figured they could
right.
deal with their
That is the correct... No, that is the correct answer. That is actually the correct answer.
Now I'm an urban person. I have to keep out of the apartment.
Yes, but that is actually the correct answer, because mice will not come where there are cats. That is the correct answer for it. That's why there is a cat in every house in Shasta. It is also why we occasionally have a kitten problem, because one of them escaped out of the net of spaying. But and you see, well, there's another thing, you may not take life, so we have to allow them to have some kittens. I let all the females have two litters, unless they are the variety that has eight at a time, in which case I consider that any woman who has eight kids has had her share, and we go from there. Go ahead, yes.
I wanted to ask you, in the Lotus book, it says, to do something by ourselves without copying others is to become an example to the world, and the merit of doing such a thing becomes the source of all wisdom. Could you talk about
yes,
that?
Yes, it's to do something because we know it to be right within ourselves, and it's the best thing we can possibly do, whether the world likes what we do or not. To do something by ourselves without copying others, without worrying about what other people are going to say about us. To do that which we know to be the right thing to do. For example, going back to our business of the cat, there's a woman from Humane Society who's constantly nagging at us about our cats. We should do this with them, we should do that with them. I'm doing that which my conscience tells me it is right to do. And we do not have a problem. You see, the beauty of using cats for this job is that that is the way in which the Cosmic Buddha set it up. I'm not getting in there.